small informal reflection on these last 8 to 10 months of anti-war organizing, specifically in New York City. We have obviously a body of very diverse activists who've been working on a variety of issues around the war, both abroad and at home, and they're going to be discussing their work over that time period and hopefully throw out some ideas to the larger group, which we can discuss together kind of as an anti-war community following their initial comments. So the facilitators will introduce the speakers. This discussion is brought to you by a group or a network that came out of a lot of the anti-war organizing here in New York City, kind of in its initial phases, called right now the Student Union Solidarity Network in New York City. And it's kind of young activists and students who've been working together, ever since September, really, and finding the need to kind of form something a little bit more concrete, kind of to fight the ebb and flow of activism and to stay together as a body that will continue to kind of communicate and coordinate around the issues of war, peace, and social justice here in the city. So with that, the website and stuff like that will be coming out soon, and hopefully you all will hear about it. But we're definitely focused just on kind of facilitating communication within the activist community, and then with a specific focus on kind of youth empowerment issues and getting young people to really be more politically active and interact also more with the general activist community in the city, something that isn't always there. So I'll hand it over to Josh.
Hi, my name is Joshua. I'm one of the facilitators for the evening. The name of tonight's event is a reflection on the past 8 months, looking backwards, moving forwards. Tonight, the speakers will look backwards for us. They will give us general themes on both a national and on a local level on how the peace movement went, according to their point of view. There are strengths, there are weaknesses, there was some internal conflict, and there was a lot of successes also. I'm just going to suggest some general guidelines for the evening. Very important one is just for everyone, and this goes without saying, but I feel like I should say it anyway, just general respect for everybody else. There's old people here, older people here, there's younger people here, excuse me. So young people, respect the voices of the experienced, and elders, respect the voices of the next generation. Respect is a very basic thing that I hope to see for this evening. And another thing is, you all are activists, you know the importance of being civic-minded, civility, and adhering to the guidelines which Marcella, the other facilitator, will outline. It's something that I ask of all of you tonight. So I'm going to pass it over to her right now.
Hi, my name is Marcella, and we just want to make sure everybody gets to ask their questions and have responses to any themes or issues that they feel they want to address. But to everyone, please, if you're shy, make sure you stand up and don't be embarrassed. For some of you, it'll be the first time. For some of you, it's maybe, like, now, I don't know. We're going to begin with having our speakers introduce themselves for 5 to 8 minutes. We will then begin to, we're actually going to start this way with having people ask questions, just so we have some kind of order. We ask that people keep their comments or questions to 2 or 3 minutes. Again, we want to get to everyone's comments and questions. And I guess feel free to ask whatever it is that you want. We also want to reinforce the thought of kind of sticking to the themes. If you do have something that maybe isn't on the agenda or you feel should be brought up, please do. But again, try to kind of keep it in the flow of the conversation. So, and state your name when you say it. And there's water in the back in case you get thirsty.
So we're going to let our speakers introduce themselves. We'll start over here.
I'm Hani Khalil. I work with War Times, Racial Justice 9/11, and United for Peace and Justice. It's good to see everybody here tonight. In the media, of course, the big question is, all right, Bush seemed to win the war, right? Invasions proceeded. Why are we still around? Why is the anti-war movement still around? Shouldn't we just go home, recognize that we lost, forget about it? And I think what's great is to see that obviously we aren't going anywhere. We're here. We're going to continue to fight. We know that this war, just because the hot phase of the war ended some time ago, and the invasion is over, but we're not very much under an occupation. And we know that we need to continue to fight. And we also know that the war in Iraq is just one piece of a much broader agenda. And I think that's part of why we're all here in the room right now. I want to talk very briefly about, because most of my work has been at the national coalition level over the last several months, year and a half or so. So I wanted to try to give a sense of where my sense is things are across the country and where our movement is. Let me begin just by talking about what it is we're facing, what it is that we could have tried to achieve over this period, just get a sense of that, and then try to take a look at where we are. So I think when we're trying to assess how well we've done and so on, you got to begin with the question of what is it that we're facing? And I think it's very clear now, particularly after this invasion of Iraq, that the invasion of Iraq was obviously it was a war for oil. But it was also a war for empire. It's part of a broader empire-building agenda of the Bush administration, shared by many sectors of the government and many powerful forces in the society. It's an attempt to try to expand U.S. power politically, economically, over the rest of the world, and to increase the military gap between any other force in the world and the United States. So basically, everybody understands if they get out of line, they could be subject to attack. That's what this is about. Internationally, domestically, it's about stripping away the rights of people at home. It's about racial profiling, it's about attacking immigrants in particular, it's about reducing the resources available for public spending on schools and education, healthcare, and moving wealth into the hands of the rich in the society. That's what this is about. And what the Bush administration has done is use September 11th to push this agenda very aggressively. I think most of us are on the same page on that, right? Pretty clear, and that's why we're here. What is it going to take to defeat this? This is not some kind of small, this is not a short-term agenda. And let's be honest, our opponents have a lot of cards in their favor. They have a very powerful government. They've used September 11th very aggressively. There still is a lot of fear in the United States. There's a lot of racism directed at Arabs and Muslims, in particular South Asians, that the Bush administration utilizes to build support. They have a very docile corporate media that's backing them up. Basically, we know that it's a very hard fight, right? But we're still at it. What are we going to need to fight this? We have to build a broad, multiracial movement that actually is serious about contesting for power. That's roughly what we need to be doing, and we've been moving towards that, I think, fairly well. Broad in the sense of multiple sectors. Can't be just youth, can't be just the religious sector. It's got to be major sectors of society. It's got to be geographically broad. Can't be limited to just the couple of coasts, New York and the Bay Area. And it's got to be serious about organizing the scale and scope. Scale in terms of numbers of people, scope in terms of the range of people that are involved, with an attempt to actually influence politics. This isn't symbolic stuff. We're actually trying to defeat an agenda. That's my sense of what we need to do. And what we're talking about then is a movement of millions, not a movement of 50,000, not a movement of 500,000 even that came out on one day here in the United States, February 15th, right? Or the 300,000 on February 16th, for instance, in San Francisco. But a movement of a scale that we haven't seen. I think it's really important that we keep in mind what we have to do, the kind of movement we need to actually defeat the agenda of the Bush administration. Very clear about that. It's a big task on our hands, and it's a task that requires all of us to stay in for the long haul. So given that that's what we need, of course, it's not something that can just be willed into existence. We want this. We organize, and therefore it comes into existence. Unfortunately, mass movements of that kind of scale depend on other kinds of conditions that we don't always have a lot of control over. And in some ways, the Bush administration's drive for Iraq was the central condition that allowed us to build to the kind of scale that we got. I like to say that Bush was our best organizer, right? It wasn't us, it was Bush. The threat of war, and it was the sense that masses of people had that if they acted, they could stop the war. right? That's what brought people out. It's both anger and opposition, and it's both a sense of hope. I think we need to keep that in mind as we try to assess what are the next steps. But that condition isn't there anymore. It's a new phase, it's an invasion, it's an occupation. So we need to think then about what are we going to need to do to try to rebuild momentum and build out again. Well, in trying to take an assessment of where we are, I would say that let's think then about, we have to be very clear about what we think were the historical possibilities at this moment. I don't think it was possible to build a broad, radical current in society over the last 9 months. Though obviously we took steps in that direction. That was not, if we had that as our goal, it shouldn't have been our goal. Was it possible to stop the Bush war in Iraq? I don't know. But we knew it was going to be damn hard, given their seriousness and intensity, or the intensity of their objectives in this, and given all the parts they had in their favor. What I think was possible is more or less what we've been able to do over this last period, though we could have done more. And if you compare it to where we were, say, after the attack on Afghanistan, we're light years ahead of where we were. After the attack on Afghanistan, I don't know if people were involved in that, trying to stop that attack, the movement just fell apart, right? Very quickly, completely demoralized. In part because of the new ability of the U.S. to wage wars, which go for a few weeks, a few months during their hot phase, and then seem to disappear, though they're in their occupation phases after that. And that's a challenge. It's very unlike the Vietnam War, which went on for as long as it did, for in its extremely visible hot phase from, say, 64 to 75. That again, was a major condition that helped propel people on the streets. It's a different kind of situation we face. And given that, I think we've moved enormously forward, given the difficulty of organizing in this kind of a period. So a few ways to just measure where we are. One question is, who are the sectors that are involved and how strong are they? So what are we geographically broad? What is the political consciousness that people have and that are involved in the movement, as well as the broad periphery of people who come out to demonstrations? What's the racial makeup of the movement? Were we able to actually contest for politics and constrain the Bush administration and their agenda at all? What are the politics that the movement is putting out? Those are some of the questions that I would look at to assess where we are. In terms of sectors, I think it's far better than I anticipated, frankly. The labor movement has come out against the war in ways that were impossible 30 years ago during the Vietnam War. Labor was far behind. This time, sectors of the labor movement moved ahead pretty early, which is remarkable. And there's actually a strong, fairly strong coalition, U.S. labor against the war, and of course here in New York City labor against the war is a major component of that. The immigrant rights movement has weighed in substantially. The religious sector, various parts of the religious community have come out against the war and have played an important role. Students and youth, obviously, are playing a central role. One difference is that in the 60s, the anti-war movement was largely led by students and youth. This time, one of the, I think, the positive sides of this is that it's a far broader movement. It's not concentrated in a handful of sectors. And communities of color, there have been major steps taken forward to organize and to work against the war, including work with racial justice 9/11, groups like Trump, organizing South Asians against the war and other detainees. We can look across the country. That's particularly important because all polls have shown that anti-war sentiment before and shortly after the war in Iraq, for the beginning of the invasion, the strongest communities of color, particularly in the African-American community. So if we want to build the power that we need to concentrate that. There's a lot of work we have to do because the challenges, the difficulties faced in the daily life struggles of communities of color, we have not been able to organize to the scale we need. That's a major challenge, I think, though we've taken important steps forward. Geographically, as I said before, the movement is far broader than it was in the 1960s, when it tended to be concentrated in the New York area and in the Bay Area, just to simplify things. This time around, War Times did an assessment. We tried to document where the anti-war movement was actually organizing, and it was frankly all across the country. We documented at least 500 cities where people were organizing in February and March, which is a massive development. In the Midwest, in the South, hell, my town, Houston, where I was raised, we had 5,000 people come out on February 15th. It's unheard of in Houston. It's not 500,000, but it's a step forward, which I think is the way to assess. In terms of consciousness, whereas there was a very narrow tunnel vision at certain moments, that a lot of folks have said we can only talk about Iraq. That's the place where people are ready to come out. Let's not talk about this. Let's not connect Iraq to the situation in Palestine. Let's not talk about the war at home. That has not been what actually has prevailed, I think, in the movement. I think there's growing understanding of both the war abroad and the war at home. And organizationally, I think there's been a much stronger connections developed between groups that work on social justice here at home with those who tended to work or do their primary work primarily around the international side and on U.S. foreign policy. That, I think, is a major step forward as well and will help to undergird a broader movement in the coming years. In its racial makeup, I think there's been important steps forward in altering the leadership and the overall structure and composition of the anti-war movement. If people remember coming to, this is one example, the United for Peace and Justice meeting when it first convened in January of this year, it was like 95% white, right? And did not reflect the city, which is more than two-thirds people of color. We've taken steps forward in challenging, in altering that situation. It's not perfect, but again, this is where I try to ask, where is the direction that we're going? Not where do we need to be, because we need to be far ahead of where we are, but are we moving in the right direction? My sense is coming out of the Chicago conference, in particular for United for Peace and Justice, is one force that I'm working with, is we have taken steps in that direction. Did people attend that? How many people went to that? I know there was lots of folks from New York who went. Okay, so just as examples, after major struggles here in New York where communities of color worked to negotiate, to also, for example, people might remember that we got an agreement with the OPJ to have 75% people of color on the speakers list on February 15th, 50% women, and so on. Those were major steps forward, and we had to push through a lot of struggles, and I think that was good. We've taken it now much further. So in Chicago, we elected a new steering committee that's 50% people of color, 50% women, is 12% queer, with a commitment to get up to 15% more people. And that's supposed to be 20% youth. We elected 12% youth. We need to fill that out. These, I think, again, are positive steps forward. And I think what was great about it was that there's recognition of the growing leadership of people of color in the movement and willingness to for people to take a step back and try to share power and share decision making. It's not perfect. There are steps to go forward. And I think this was a positive step. Another piece that I'll briefly mention as well is, again, much of the anti-war movement has tried to shy away from the question of Palestine historically. And for example, since February 15th, when we were trying to organize for that, there was not unity on this at all within many of the sectors of the movement. A lot of folks wanted to try to keep it out of sight. That's not the case anymore. It's not something because of what UFPJ did or anybody did. It's because of the Palestinians resisting the occupation. Because there's been a growing international movement, international solidarity movement, perhaps the people here who are working with it. And that has altered and pushed through a new understanding within the broad anti-war movement as the centrality and the links between Iraq and Palestine in terms of U.S. support and attempts to control the Middle East and the way that Israel is involved in that. At the Chicago conference again, whereas there had been major debate over, for example, what position we were going to take on Palestine in the unity statement, over the 2 or 3 months, it's a monster for some of us involved in that. By the time we got there, there was actually pretty strong support to support an end to Israel's occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, and a challenge to end U.S. policies that support that. These, I think, are major steps forward for our movement. Quickly on some challenges. Though the core of our movement is very strong, we did not do a good job of retaining those masses of people who came out to our demonstrations. We did a better job mobilizing people than in organizing people, in the sense of bringing them into an organization, training them, developing them as organizers and as leaders. It's a major weakness, and we lost a major opportunity. We need to think about ways to try to capture and retain people. I think we need to think about ways to combine both mass action, like the mobilizations that we did over these past few months, with campaigns which are really targeted at actually trying to win changes in legislation. Repealing the Patriot Act, pushing through legislation that would demand that Bush turn over what he supposedly knew or what information they had about the so-called weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. These kinds of things that can help us give people a sense of hope These are incremental victories. They're far from what we need, but they help to move us in the direction and give people a sense that they can stay in this and keep the long-term in view as well. We need to keep Palestine in front. We can't let that fall away. And I think we also need to figure out ways where, while we've been able to successfully broaden our perception of what the issues are and the struggles that we're going to take on, to link the anti-war movement with the global justice movement, the immigrant rights movement with the anti-war movement. These are major steps forward. At the same time, we need to figure out ways to keep a concentration on the most cutting-edge aspects of the war. Most recently, it was around Iraq. We need to continue to keep a focus on Iraq, even under the difficult conditions of trying to get people to organize against an occupation, even though it's hard. And we need to try to take advantage of any opportunities we have to reduce the credibility of the Bush administration. Right now, Bush is incredibly vulnerable, for instance, on the lies that they told about the supposed weapons of mass destruction. We need to be out there pushing that so we can get people to recognize that these were lies. If we reduce his credibility on that, it'll help us stave off. It'll be much harder for the Bush administration to go after yet another country, be it Cuba, Korea, Iran, Syria, etc. So those are some of the things that I would like to put up.
Okay, cool.
Okay. Hi, I'm Julie Zuckerman from New Yorkers Say No to War and United for Peace and Justice. I thought I'd just talk briefly about, kind of lay out the calendar of the past 10 months or whatever, just to remind us of what's gone on in New York. Of course, all of this began with 9/11 and I think after the invasion of Afghanistan, people went back into their various groups and laid low for several months last winter and spring. And around about the end of last spring, people came together to decide what to do about September, the anniversary of September 11th. People from a variety of groups, what were the 50 or 60 groups represented in the beginning of what came to be called stand-up, gathered, and there were a lot of heated debates about what was going to be the event. It turned out that by the end of the summer and after all of this arguing and haggling, there was a march and a rally to Union Square, from Times Square to Union Square, on September 8th. And there were 1,500 people there, which was not enormous, but was just the beginning of things to come. It was not long after that, on October 6th, that NION had a much larger rally in Central Park, about 25 to 30,000 people in the park that day, which was a huge jump in about a month, which was then followed October 26th by 150,000, 200,000 people in D.C. For that march in D.C., that was the kickoff for United for Peace and Justice nationally. That was the first meeting of people from across the country. As Hanny said, it was not racially representative at all. And we left from that feeling that there was a real need to have a national network movement, sense that there was a movement, that it wasn't enough to be a bunch of disparate groups doing things, and that we wanted to be called something so that it had some recognition. And it was called United for Peace, and then became United for Peace and Justice. We came back to New York City, and there still was not a feeling that people in town could gather under one name. But we had a couple of meetings in November, and then one in November, and we were moving forward. That was right before the Uptown March that Uptown for Peace and Justice organized. So we worked together to pull that off. And I think what was useful about that is groups that hadn't worked together before were working together then in good faith. And I think there was a lot of feeling from the people uptown that, well, you know, are all these white folks who were downtown actually going to get their behinds up there and going to mobilize other folks to get uptown? And I think it happened, and there was good feeling at that rally. After January 1st, actually on January 2nd, there was a large meeting at the Rec Forum, and there were something like 80 groups represented there. There still was not a feeling that we wanted to be United for Peace and Justice, New York City, or anything like that. It was just like, okay, we've had our problems in the past, and we still don't really trust each other, but there's going to be a national rally march in New York City on February 15th. Why don't we commit ourselves to work together to pull that off and see what happens? And what happened initially was that it was a lot of white folks getting together the first week. We had 5 or 6 weeks to pull it off. And the first week it was a lot of white folks, and then it changed dramatically come the third week or so. And by the time February 15th rolled around, I think a lot of us had really slogged through a lot of stuff and pulled off a really phenomenal day, which was then followed by the march, which didn't happen on the 15th, which was March 22nd. The problem we saw in United for Peace and Justice for the March 22nd event was that the representation that we managed to get together for February 15th didn't stick. It didn't hold. So the next meetings afterwards were not as ethnically representative, and March 22nd kind of got pulled off in a much less representative fashion, but was, again, an enormous event, and we came together after that feeling that we needed to do something to structure what was going on in New York City so that it would be representative of the various groups, neighborhoods, communities, interests, and I guess sometime in April or May we decided to assume that we had a United for Peace and Justice in New York City, developed a coordinating committee for that, which is consists of a member from any group that wants to come and participate, and then there's a smaller administrative committee, which basically just does the grunt work, and was also, we were clear through the structuring of that it would be ethnically and gender diverse and the schmear. I think that what occurred in our thinking through of what was going on in New York City in terms of percentages and representation and voting, and this, one of the things we decided was that anything we voted on we'd have to get at least 60% agreement on, because we couldn't go ahead with an action unless there was more than a simple majority. You know, there really needed to be some force behind things. And these were things that once we played them out in New York, then got were useful for how things were going to work out nationally. The big problem right now, as we all know, is we've lost the adrenaline rush I think pretty much after March 22nd, and when Bush declared the war over, although we know it's not, and we all still are carrying on, it's very hard to mobilize people and keep ourselves going in the same way. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm a full-time parent, full-time teacher, and I was a full-time activist, and it's like running three full-time jobs was not too easy. You can do it when you've got that intense adrenaline pumping. So I feel that that's a really significant issue we have right now, and it's not something that we should be feeling we're having we have some letdown. We ought to be realistic about that and take this time now to do things that are quieter, less sexy, don't bring out the same number of people, but are really going to fortify the structures and the organizations that we need as we're going into an electoral season and trying to repeal the Patriot Act. So that's my spiel.
My name is Mike from New York Youth Bloc. It's a coalition of high school students from around the city that formed in January of 2002 around the World Economic Forum mobilization and kind of adapted itself to various issues along the way, including the campaign against the budget cuts to our public schools and the anti-war movement all of this year. We've grown over the course of the year to about 50 schools citywide, every borough. Personally from Hunter High School, and I think that as a movement, youth have played a role that was essential but not exclusive. Of course, as in some cases, I think it was, from what I hear, in the 60s. I'd like to just raise a few questions and raise a few thoughts, and there's no real organized structure to this, but I'm just going to put this out there. First of all, Youth Bloc was based on youth as a basis of our unity. Most other organizations were based on political, cultural, geographic, ethnic basis. I think there's value in every single one of those, but we as a generation were facing this year a full frontal assault on us. We were the ones being sent to war, our friends and family being sent to war. We're the ones who had our funding taken away from our schools, from our public schools, and put right into the war machine and right into recruiting. And we faced some criticism for being based in schools rather than communities, communities in the traditional sense. But at the same time, there are communities of youth that often aren't recognized by organizations that are run by older people. And I'd like to put the question out there, what was the impact of not having a lot of young people in positions of decision-making in the broader anti-war movement? Did that hinder the movement at any point? What was the impact of, possibly ageism and people seeing young people as less capable of doing work and doing what had to be done? The experience of older activists as a merit versus what was often creative thinking and creative action by younger people. And one of the main reasons that Youth Bloc was formed in the first place was so that high school students specifically, people of high school age, we were limited to people 18 and under, could make decisions for themselves, set their own directions, set their own priorities, because there wasn't really a space for that in the city. And a lot of people saw that need and kind of put in the work to fill that need. Another thing is that Youth Bloc was decentralized, has been decentralized, and non-hierarchical from the beginning. We don't have an official leadership, and I think that's really benefited us. What is the benefit of that versus top-down organization? Organization where you have a committee of people making decisions supposedly on behalf of the larger interests, but in some cases, in some actions, we saw where that didn't really vibe well with the desires of the majority. For example, I think on February 15th, the decision not to march was something that was contradicted by the majority of people. Not to criticize anyone, personally, but just the decision was not something that was in line with what a lot of people wanted to see. And I think that was shown in the abundance of freedom marches that developed over the course of 3 days, I think, about 70 freedom marches. In the case of the youth freedom march, we were attacked by police. In the case of a lot of the freedom marches by adult activists, they were not, and they were, you know, because they knew that they could get away with attacking youth more than they could get away with attacking, say, labor. And I think that there were alliances that could have been made, such as between youth and labor in the movement, that could have made the movement a lot stronger at certain points. And I think those alliances can be explored in the future. I'm not saying that we should, you know, lose hope of those alliances. But that's another thing, is that the partnership between Youth Bloc and other organizations, specifically local organizations, Uptown for Peace and Justice, media organizations like Rise Up Radio and WBAI, and United for Peace and Justice, of course, and not in our name, providing resources that we didn't really have as young people. We don't know how to, you know, write grants, and we don't necessarily know how to fundraise to the extent that more established organizations do. And that's where they helped us out. At the same time, it created a kind of dependence on those organizations for those resources that maybe limited us in certain ways. For example, there were rallies that we co-sponsored with organizations where they were presented as solely rallies by that organization rather than really a youth bloc, a joint youth bloc, that organization rally. Often people kind of claiming, you know, credit for grassroots organizing, where the high school students were kind of getting, you know, the short end of the stick in terms of what we were doing, and therefore having less chance to speak and less chance to, you know, express where we were coming from specifically as young people. Also, I think that there are concrete links between local justice and global peace movements that could have been explored further. For example, one of the very concrete links is the fact that it's necessity that drives most young people to join the military. It's not because they want to join the military. It's not some ethic of my generation that says we want to be in the Army, we want to be in the Air Force, so that's sexy. It's not. Most people don't really want to be there. I mean, I have friends who were sent off to Iraq who didn't want to go to Iraq, but they had to. They were promised financial aid, they were promised, you know, aid for college, probably not going to get it, but that's the case. And that's a local justice issue, because we don't have, a lot of people in my generation do not have the opportunities that people may have had, you know, that people might have who are, you know, older or who are more in these established organizations. And then when young people are organizing for themselves, they face, you know, the daily life issues that some people don't really have to face. And I think the links between those could have been made stronger, such as an anti-recruitment campaign should have happened about a year ago. It's just starting off now, basically, and there were people in young people in Bushwick High School who organized a protest a few months ago, and they didn't really get any of the support from the broader movement that they should have gotten. And people doing those kinds of actions around the country should have gotten more support for the local work that requires. Another thing is that I think in terms of our effectiveness as a movement, it was not just the numbers of people in the bullpens, and it's not just, you know, the numbers that we got out in the streets. It was, at a certain point, there was a certain energy, a certain militancy, and a certain originality in what a lot of people were hearing from, you know, about the anti-war movement. They're like, wow, a day in which, you know, 10 million people around the world just coordinated their actions and were out in the streets en masse. When people heard about, you know, what a few times that we've taken the streets, you know, when we were supposed to have just been kept on the sidewalk, and young people just flowed out into the streets and took their own kind of direct action. I think people saw in that the hope for reclaiming our spaces and reclaiming parts of our lives that had been taken from us in ways that affect us directly and not just indirectly, not just saying this is wrong, this war is wrong, but we're actually reclaiming parts of our lives that have been stolen from us. And that includes using organizations as kind of autonomous zones. In Youth Bloc, at meetings and at protests, or even at, you know, gatherings or parties, it's a lot of it is about having our own space in which we determine what happens, and we determine the conditions in which we organize or we work or we party or we live or we go to school. And I think that's a really important thing to remember, is that when people start to see more their own control over their own lives, that's when they can really be, you know, inspired to take action and stick with it, because they feel power, not individual power, but collective power. Power as a generation. Power as the anti-war movement had felt, I think, at February 15th, and even as late as March 22nd or March 5th, when hundreds of schools around the country went on strike against the war. And in New York, we had about 5,000 high school students out in Union Square. And I think from that point on, people started to lose a little hope. I think among a lot of young people, there's a cynicism now. There's a feeling that, well, there's nothing we can do to change things. There's nothing that we can do to affect policy and affect what our government is doing. And that's what's keeping a lot of people home. It's not because they trust the government. I mean, this is from years of experience as a high school organizer, I can say that my generation does not trust the government. My generation does not trust the military to the extent that the media presents it. But I would say that people are just kind of, you know, what are we going to do? What can we do to change things? And I think local justice movements offer that kind of hope, because that's a level on which we can often have some kind of effect. We won in the battle over the budget cuts. We won $300 million back in funding for our schools. Local justice struggles can often offer people that kind of hope. And I think that's where we've got to take it now, as well as keeping our eye on the global situation. In terms of the global situation, let me just address this quickly. I think a lot of people have been wondering where the movement has been, not just in terms of Iraq, but and not just in terms of Palestine, also in terms of, say, Aceh in Indonesia, in terms of Burma, in terms of Iran. Why aren't we supporting student movements that are actually pressing for their own self-determination and saying, we oppose the war, we oppose our government's agenda, our government's desire to take over the government of Iraq and then take over the government of Iran, probably. But we're not in the streets, you know, supporting fellow young people who are fighting for self-determination. In Aceh, where it's the same situation as Palestine, where the United States is funding the Indonesian government and giving it training in how to, you know, wage counter-terrorism campaigns, which is really just a war of its own against the people of Aceh, and young people in Aceh are being lined up and shot. Why isn't the movement in the streets asserting, you know, that we will apply the same standards to every government that does not respect its people as people and respects them as only as pawns or objects or people who are expendable? And I think that we might be losing moral capital because of that, and I think we should be just as visible on issues that arise, including in Iraq right now, where people were massacred and continue to be massacred. Young people, high school students in Fallujah, were gunned down by U.S. troops, and there were no protests in New York City or around the country that I'm aware of. People were gunned down in Mosul. People were gunned down on a daily basis. And American troops, young people, were sent over there on a false basis and are now being killed daily. And I think that there's even more potential right now for people on a mass basis gaining even more consciousness than they gained from, you know, months of anti-war organizing before shit hit the fan. And now that they're seeing the results of it, we're seeing the results of the lives, we're seeing the results of what our government has been doing in terms of lives, in terms of body bags. Young people, seeing young people dying, whether they're American or Iraqi or Iranian. And I think there's enormous potential in terms of building a global justice movement that is also a global peace movement, and also reclaiming a lot of ideas from the government, from the administration that's been using them for their own, you know, kind of devious ways, like freedom. Who said that their concept? Who says that their rhetoric? That's our rhetoric. We're demanding freedom for, you know, for the young people of this country. We're demanding freedom for communities of color and immigrant communities that are under attack in this country. We're demanding freedom for people around the world who are fighting for their own freedom and not having us to fight for them. And I think that's really essential, is that we have to reclaim freedom, peace, justice, these basic concepts that, you know, have mobilized millions of people under their banner, but now we have to reclaim that along with the rest of our lives.
Thank you.
I thought that was terrific. I asked to go after Mike because I was really impressed with that. I'm Christine Karanitsky. Before I start, I want to make very clear, because I have a really explicit. Oh, okay. Because I have a really explicit political content, I want to make very clear to you that I'm speaking as an individual member of the organizations that I belong to. I'm going to be talking to you about NYCLAW, the New York City Labor Against War Coalition. And I want to acknowledge that Barbara Zelick is here from that organization, Wayne Price is here from that organization, and the subsection Teachers Against War. I didn't want to stand up. All right. I'm an anarchist. I have been doing all of my organizing explicitly from an anarchist perspective. So I just want everybody to be clear that these are my opinions and my views and so on, and not the views of the groups that I'm a part of. I've been a librarian in the public library system for 19 years. And for most of that time, I've been a trade union activist. And that's really been the scope of my organizing. I've participated in enormous amount of labor struggles in this city, in solidarity across the country, even some foreign struggles. But they were, dare I say, limited in scope, even though struggling against the boss is never limited. But I never had an explicit set of politics until the Seattle demonstrations happened, and in New York, the group Direct Action Network and its subsection, Labor Solidarity Working Group, formed. And having already been plugged into various labor struggles in New York, I found out about this group. And lo and behold, there were anarchists there. And I discovered anarchist politics and realized that I, too, was an anarchist. So I just, you know, want to give you a little bit of context. I also belong to a political organization. Wayne and I are members of an anarchist collective called Open City, and we belong to a group called NEFAC, which is the Northeastern Federation of Anarcho-Communists. This is a class struggle group of anarchists that is organized around the political platform. And we do all of our work kind of grounded in class struggle politics, which is perfect for me, having come from labor. This is where my work has been. So I want to hand out to you some statements that we've written so you can get a sense of where we're coming from. I work with another group called Anti-Racist Action, and here is a newspaper that is put out by the LA group. And you can have a look at that too. And I also have two proposals. One of them is in writing, and it's more fully cooked than the other proposal. But just to tell you about the work that I've been doing, at the NION event in Central Park, I had 2 minutes to say that what we needed to do to stop the war was strike. And regardless of the, I mean, I thought that was such a terrific presentation, regardless of the respect that I have for the youth bloc and all of the social movements represented here, if we are only going to organize against the war or against imperialism without grounding it in class struggle, you're not going to stop anything. To stop the war, workers who have the power to do so have to withhold their labor. I mean, you know, this is like Marx 101, and I don't consider myself a very sophisticated political theorist, but that is what has to happen. And it is very difficult. One of the, I guess I would say, failures or weaknesses of the labor movement or the organizing in the labor movement is we don't have the power to strike. I'm a public employee. I'm affiliated with AFSCME. I'm in the New York Public Library Guild. AFSCME Local 1930. We're affiliated with District Council 37 downtown. As a public employee, there's something in New York State called the Taylor Law, which prevents me from striking. So I can't take a job action to tell this world, and not just this government, this world, that I'm going to withhold my labor until you stop this bloody war. I can't do it. So there is necessarily a solution, and I agree there are some legislative avenues that we have to pursue. For example, I would support a obviously I would support a repeal of the Patriot Act, but these things aren't enough. To repeal the Taylor Law, repeal the Taft-Hartley Act, which was invoked against the dock workers in California specifically. Bush invoked the Taft-Hartley Act to keep the dock workers from striking. They were going to wage a job action against the war. Bush invoked Taft-Hartley, criminalized them basically, and just completely neutralized their power to make a decisive action against the war. In New York City, we've had rumblings from the Transit Workers Union. These things are percolating. And what I would say, they're beginning to percolate more. Earlier in June, there was a conference of labor leaders sponsored by the New York City Central Labor Council. It was people from the Professional Staff Congress, from the transit workers, all other groups, talking about the right to strike, talking about the repeal of the Taylor Law, and all of these things, trying to reinvest labor, reclaim labor's power over our work. So there are rumblings, but it needs to come from you too. We need to hear from you. You need to put pressure on labor. It was an excellent point you made. Why isn't labor reaching out to youth? I would make reference to the very famous example of the May 1968 demonstrations in France, which were completely led by the youth movement. However, the weakness was there was no oomph in it until labor got involved. And when the CGT pulled out, it died. So we need to find a way to work with each other in a sustainable fashion. You have a different social power, or you will develop your social power. And all of you, even if you're self-employed, you work somewhere. We've got to assert that, and that's what's going to stop the war. Now, so that's that. That's striking. The other thing I would say in response to something Hani said, it is not enough to defeat the Bush administration. Sure, I would love to defeat the Bush administration, but I just don't want to elect a better president. I don't support any electoral campaign. I wouldn't support a Democratic Party candidate. I just read something today from the Working Families Party about what their next steps are. I don't support the Working Families Party. I don't support any political party. I think people need to take direct control of this completely outside of electoral politics. We've got to get out of this because it will be an endless cycle, and people like you and people of color will continue to suffer. We really need to ground this. If you want to move it forward, you need to ground this in class struggle. It's not enough simply to fight imperialism. The last thing I think I will say are about my two proposals. I mentioned, the difficulties organizing workers to strike. Part of it is, the legal system against us. Part of it is a certain amount of complacency or lack of confidence. People don't know what it is to strike. Somebody would have to tell me how to organize a strike for work. So what I was thinking, and this is the proposal that's kind of less baked than the other one, I'm thinking that we need to organize strike committees wherever we are. And the first idea that I had was in housing. We've just had this dreadful decision by wherever it came down from, Pataki or whatever. Everybody's rents are going to go up. And I was thinking that perhaps we could organize strike committees, even, if you're living in a dorm, wherever it is, even as a symbolic action, to organize strike committees where you live. And let's see if we can start making these statements. And maybe that will put some pressure or create an environment where the word strike isn't, something out of mythology, where it's not something out of a foreign country or labor's long dead past. Okay, so that's one proposal, organizing strike committees, and really I didn't get much further with it than that. The other proposal is more fully baked, and it ties in with all of these other issues. It ties in with the struggle for Palestinian liberation. It ties in with the detainees and all of these things. I only have a few copies. I can print out more. This is a proposal and an invitation for a demonstration in New York, Pennsylvania. And I'll just read you the first paragraph. On June 15th, a group of activists from New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Maryland, and they were activists from Anti-Racist Action and NEFAC, my group, to discuss a plan for a demonstration and a campaign concerning immigrants' rights and the occupation of Palestine. The demonstration will focus on both the York County Jail and the nearby Caterpillar Distribution Center. We envision the demonstration at York County Jail as being a mass event to create nationwide attention concerning the secret arrests and detentions of immigrants in this new climate of increased repression and attacks on civil liberties. York County Jail is a major hub for the Department of Homeland Security's newly created Bureau of Citizenship and Immigration Services and the biggest detention center on the East Coast. Now, from New York, you know, our close to our heart is Farouk Abdelmoukti, who is in that detention center. And a lot of this campaign focuses on his detention specifically, demands that he has made, which this campaign would support. And so I make this proposal to you that you all consider this, bring this back to the groups that you participate in, and let us mobilize a New York coalition to take part in this. Thank you.
My name is Mona Mee, and I'm with an organization called DRUM, Daisies Rising Up and Moving, and we're an immigrant rights organization. For people who don't know the term, Daisy means people of South Asian descent, and even that term, South Asian, we've had to do massive education around in the past year and a half. People don't even know what that is for the most part, but it refers to people from Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, Trinidad, Guyana, Nepal, Sri Lanka, Bhutan, and the diaspora from the subcontinent. Our organization, what I'm going to talk about is sort of like the other anti-war movement, and I'll explain what that means. And also talking about really a lot of the issues that have come up by the different speakers around representation and issues of power, race, class, gender, sexuality, and why that's been such major issues in the anti-war movement, and how we need to really address those in order to move forward. So my organization works with families and immigrants who've been detained and racially profiled and deported since 9/11. So just a very brief background, I'm sure a lot of people here probably are educated about it, but since 9/11 the government says that 1,200 people have been detained and or deported. Our numbers from doing the work on the ground is that it's a lot more than that. Just in the New York City area alone, it's at least 1,200 people. We've worked with over 300 of those people in the past year and a half and their families, mostly in local county jails and federal facilities like Passaic County Jail, Hudson County Jail, Middlesex in New Jersey, as well as the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. At this point, the so-called 9/11 detainees, primarily South Asian and Arab immigrants who were detained, for the most part have been deported, have been sent back to their home countries. Very few of the over 1,200 have been released on bond or bail. And of those who had been released through major struggles and organizing campaigns, many of them subsequently lost their deportation cases and eventually had to leave either voluntarily or involuntarily. So we've been dealing with the situation in the past year and a half as an organization that's membership-based, and our membership is primarily undocumented and non-citizen immigrants, primarily South Asian, but also more and more Arab and Muslim. And also we were working with immigrants from all over the world detained long before 9/11. As an organization made up of that constituency, doing anti-war work and the whole idea of what anti-war organizing means a whole different thing. It is literally a day-to-day challenge, struggle, risk, that families and community members and detainees take. And it's really important to put out because I think it's really the invisible face of the anti-war movement in the U.S. And I think also some of the arrogance of the U.S. sort of worldwide, globally, is that we don't often recognize not only third world communities right here in the U.S., but the struggles and the leadership of the third world in doing anti-imperialist and anti-war organizing. We're not the only ones, and we're not the first ones, and we didn't start the anti-globalization movement. Seattle did not begin it, and that's really important to understand in building broader movements and building movements that are in solidarity with third world people. In terms of like what detention organizing and how that's connected to anti-war organizing, if you ask folks in our communities, for us the main struggle has not been education and bringing people onto our side. So it's a very different struggle than I think white middle class America has, or even citizens have, for the large part. For us, most of our community clearly makes the connection between the raids that are happening in their neighborhoods, the detentions, and the war. And so that's a given. But what is the hard part for us is to be able to be public and express protest in sort of the traditional forms of protest that you see in this country. So for the most part, our members and our community members are not at all the different mobilizations and protests that people have been talking about and can never be at those mobilizations and protests if the conditions continue to be what they are. So we need to really think about creative ways in engaging in anti-war work and creative ways that people and communities have already been doing that outside of mass mobilizations in DC or protests in New York or downtown. I mean, the fact is a lot of immigrant folks can't travel outside of even within their state. Boarding a bus or boarding an airplane is just something that's a high risk. And so we can't mobilize people to go to DC. One of the things that we can do and that we've tried to do but also has been hard is to bring mobilizations into our communities, to create that public resistance culture in ways that are accessible for people who are undocumented, who are being directly targeted within their own neighborhoods. And so, strangely enough, maybe not so, one of the biggest, I think, anti-war forums we've had in the community is around the issue of detentions and most recently special registrations. A lot of our organizing strategy on those issues have been to use those issues, to work on those issues, but to create the forum where people come together for Know Your Rights clinics or legal clinics as also forums for anti-war dialogues, discussion, and action. And it really has been that. And I think that, you know, a lot of our community members long ago also realized that the legal system and the legal strategies is not going to work. For most of the thousands of people who've been detained, they've lost their legal cases. The Patriot Act and the policies that are coming down are much too large to be fighting against individually in the courts. So when we have legal clinics, and you know, I'm sure people have heard that that's been one of the things that have been happening nationwide, especially in response to the special registrations, our understanding is that legal clinics are important. Yes, people have to know their legal rights and the framework of individual legal rights, but those should all be tools for organizing as well. Those should be tools for building a base within a community for people who will come to a forum like that to talk about their personal experiences with the INS and registration and link it and almost always talk about the war and talk about the war on terrorism and how it is endless and the militarism in South Asia and what that means for them here. And so we've been able to use those forums as a way to build our base. And I think, you know, other people have talked about this before, and I can't stress it enough that it is, I think, one of the biggest failures of not just the anti-war movement, but I think of a lot of activism that happens, is that people confuse activism with organizing. And I think they are very different things, and we have to understand that and really respect the history of community organizing and political organizing and how that's different from activism. And how organizing is what builds movements. And activism is important, but we need people committed day to day in these communities and campuses and unions to build those bases and to build the leadership of more and more people, not just the same people. And so that's really what we've tried to focus on. Even though, you know, it's been a period where it's sort of attack after attack after attack for our communities, about 6 months ago, we made a critical decision internally within our organization that we need to stop functioning in crisis mode. We need to stop responding to all of the attacks. We know that there are going to be more, and we need to really sit down and create our strategy for the long haul, because we need to survive and be here for the many, many years to come. And the way I think a lot of the immigrant rights movement was functioning was not going to allow us to be around for a while. It was just too intensive and too much going on. One of the other things I want to mention is locally what this has meant for us is the anti-war coalitions and activities that we've been a part of are ones that are rooted in and grounded in the leadership of mass-based and community of color organizations. And those two things for us are really important, because it's one thing to have coalitions where people come to the coalitions as individuals with analysis that, you know, may be wonderful and great and encompassing, but as individuals, it's a very different political power and capacity of coalitions than coalitions that are rooted in mass-based or community-based or membership-based organizations. I don't know how many people here have heard of what happened in New York City in early May called Operation Homeland Resistance. How many people here have heard of that? So quite a few people, and I'm glad, because my feeling after organizing that with a lot of other groups in New York is that unfortunately it didn't get nearly the level of coverage and support and solidarity that it should have. And I think for the folks who organized that, it really spoke to sort of the climate of the anti-war movement broadly. So Operation Homeland Resistance was initiated and planned and strategized by community-based organizations led by people of color and in people of color communities, working on a broad range of issues of war at home. Everything from policing to racial profiling to prisons to education to housing to welfare. And so these organizations, from the direction of their membership, our memberships, for us that meant that we were going to visit people in detention centers and asking them actually about where should sites for civil disobedience be. What do you think about civil disobedience at the INS headquarters? Is that safe? Is that going to have repercussions? And we were trying to do that even with people locked up in jail, not just making those decisions in a vacuum by ourselves. And so 3 days of creative actions took place at the INS, now called the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement Headquarters, in 26 Federal Plaza, and about 100 people were arrested. But what was really critical and I think powerful about the message of Operation Homeland Resistance was that the principles were that the leadership, the framework came from membership bases in communities of color who were at the front lines of the war abroad and the war at home. And that the people who put their bodies out to be able to get arrested at the INS building were primarily citizens. And a lot of them were anti-racist white allies who were citizens and knew that they can take that risk in this political moment. And taking that risk was really critical, because not just for the sake of doing that, but what that effectively can do is raise the bar of resistance and make it a generally more safe climate and create a situation where communities of color and immigrant communities see this happening and understand that, you know, that does make it safer for immigrants and other people to resist and create more forms of resistance. You know, I think what I'll end with is just the idea of looking at that as really a model. And we really hope that that could be a model that could be replicated and used and expanded around the country. And to that end, we are also connected with and work really closely in a national network
of people of color-based, membership-based organizations doing anti-war work called Racial Justice 911. And unfortunately, I think one thing that often happens is that when you talk about the broader anti-war coalitions, RJ911 is not even on the map. But politically, if you look at the organizations that are in there, we're representing lots and lots of people doing really important work day-to-day in communities across the country.
Hi, my name is Kyoko Wakray. I'm from Peace Williamsburg, and also I work at El Puente in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and I work with UFPJ as well. I want to thank everyone who spoke before because I think there's some really important points that were raised, and I'm going to talk specifically, I'm going to try to focus on community, because I think it's really important to focus on our individual communities, our local community organizing. And I think a lot of the points that you made are really important, that the only way this movement's going to sustain is if we nurture our own communities and our community organizations. I think one of the major problems in mobilizing people, like Hani and Julie mentioned, is that we were able to mobilize a lot of people to the major demonstrations in New York City. But as time goes on, as people feel discouraged, there are less and less people. And we might be strong in mobilizing, but we are weak in organizing. And I think we have to really listen to what the needs are of people in our communities. Like you mentioned, you know, people are afraid of coming out to demonstrations because of their immigration status. And we need to look at that and not just expect people to show up at major demonstrations, because I just don't see that as a way of sustaining this movement. I think I want to try to be really positive and focus on the things that I think have been successful and that I've seen within our own community in Williamsburg. And I think some major success that we've seen is rooted in taking responsibility within our own communities, individuals taking responsibility. That, you know, Williamsburg is a really interesting neighborhood. It's a very diverse neighborhood. And we're seeing a lot of, obviously, new people moving into the community. And it's becoming this really hip place to live. And a lot of people don't realize that there's, they kind of treat Williamsburg as this sort of blank slate, you know, that they can paint it however they want. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff happening, but people don't see it as a lot of people don't see it as a community that they live in, that they're part of, and they don't take responsibility for that. And I think that's a really important thing. And to be aware of the history in that neighborhood, in our own neighborhoods, that there in Williamsburg, there's been a lot of activism in the past, a very rich history. And one of our goals is to inspire people, especially if people who are moving into the neighborhood are not aware of the activism that's taken place in the neighborhood, and to encourage people to take initiative. So that's the first point. Our second point is building trust within the community, really listening to the needs of the people in the community, the diversity of the community, and you know, there are a lot of different groups within Williamsburg. And for example, we have the People's Firehouse, who's been fighting to, their firehouse was closed by the mayor on May 22nd, and they've been fighting to reopen the firehouse. Now, they're not necessarily against the war, but I think there's a lot of strength in trying to build a coalition between our groups, and that has been happening, and they've been very receptive, and they it's been really great seeing our relationship grow. So I think we have to not ignore different groups that don't necessarily have the same political agenda or beliefs, but to try to really build those coalitions. And the third point is that individuals need to take initiative. I think I encourage people to take initiative, whoever you are, no matter what your age is, what your background is, what your beliefs are, that everyone has the strength to take initiative themselves. And if you don't have a group in your community, to start one. Again, I'm gonna keep talking about Peace Williamsburg, but we started Meredith Gary, who's here tonight, and she hates it when I do this, but she had a screening of a film called The Hidden Wars of Desert Storm back in November, and actually Bilal was there too, and he spoke, and it was a great evening, and we had a very interesting discussion following the film, and we realized that there are a lot of people who were really angry about what was happening and concerned. And that grew into a group that now meets every week, every Wednesday, and since November. I think we've been meeting every week. We've only missed two Wednesdays. And, you know, we continue to grow, and we've done a lot of great things in the neighborhood. But it really just started with people listening to each other, what our concerns were. And so I think if every community had this, you know, a kind of organization where it's... maybe it just starts out with a discussion about what people's individual concerns are, and it can grow into something else. But I think it's really important for people to take initiative on whatever level. Also, education is really important. One of the reasons why we started this group was because people felt that there was a lack of education, and we were ready to admit that, yeah, you know what, there's a lot we don't know, and there's a lot we can learn from each other. We have a lot of different resources, a lot of different talents within our group, and we can help educate one another. And then the final thing is choosing your battles. I think, you know, it's really exhausting doing this work, and you have to be selective about what battles you choose. We can't fight every single issue, and I think that's the other strength of having a community group, is that if you can focus on the issues surrounding, you know, within your community, it gives you a focus, it gives you grounding, and it's a great way to build a larger coalition. And we had a film night on Tuesday at Galapagos in Williamsburg, and it was really great to see so many different people there. We started the evening out with one of the aims of the evening was to show activism in Williamsburg and beyond, and Jay organized the evening. Anyways, we started with the first film was about El Puente, which is an organization that's been in existence for a long time in Williamsburg, and it mainly works with the Latino community. We showed that film first, then we showed the People's Firehouse, which is about our local firehouse that was shut down in 75, and local residents occupied the firehouse for over a year and managed to reopen the firehouse fully. And, you know, we realized a lot of people probably weren't even aware of that happening in the neighborhood. So we showed that. So we had some people from the firehouse who spoke afterwards, which was really moving. Adam Vineski, who's featured in the film, was the major organizer in 75. His son was there on Tuesday, Paul Vineski, and he spoke about the struggle that's going on right now in Williamsburg. There are people outside the firehouse who've been there since May 23rd. Every day around the clock in this encampment, and they know that, you know, this firehouse might not reopen, but a lot of it is symbolic for them, and it's really important to show that we're not giving up. The truck is still in the firehouse. It's the only truck out of all the six firehouses that have been closed that is still there, and it's a way of saying, you know, I think this film showed a lot of people that it is possible to fight back. And so I think it's important to focus on the positive things, you know, the successes, the people that have come before us who have achieved really amazing things. And so I guess my point about that was that, you know, we had people from the firehouse there, and then we ended the night with, this is what democracy looks like. And, you know, there are people there nodding their heads, watching this, going, yeah, this is the same struggle, you know, that all these different struggles. We might all have different agendas, different beliefs, but we are united, and that these battles are really the same thing. We're all fighting for peace, justice. So I want to keep it short because I'm really anxious to hear what people have to say, but I guess my main points are is to really look into your own communities and to understand what the needs are of the community. And as Mike was saying earlier, that, you know, we do have the power to create our own communities, to create that sense of community and to make it what we want it to be, a place where we want to live. It's not just a place where you crash at night, you know. A lot of people in Williamsburg work in the city, they go back and it's like, that's just, you know, where they hang out and go to the bars. Well, why is it that way, you know? that there is this alternative, that you can be an example to others and create a space where you are connecting with people every day at all times. And it doesn't have to be heavy. It doesn't have to be work all the time. It can be fun. That, you know, you gain support from others. And I think in terms of sustaining the movement, you know, in a very logistical sense, having a community-based organization, it's a lot easier when you can meet every week and you all live nearby each other. You know, it's a lot easier than for us to be going into the city and meeting with people from all over the city. So I would just say there are a lot of merits to that, and that I think there is a lot of great organizing that is happening on a local level. And if this was happening all throughout the country, which it is, that's when, you know, things are really going to start changing, when people have the courage to speak out in their own communities and not be afraid, because people are pissed off all over the country. And that's obvious. You know, you see it in graffiti all the time. You see it in the bathrooms. I walk to work and it says, and there's this graffiti that says, Bush sucks, you know, and it just, that encourages me every day, knowing that there are people, you know, all over the country who feel that way. And maybe they don't feel, they don't have the power, they don't feel strong enough to come out and say that. But it's, you see it all over the place. And so, just, you know, I would just encourage people to really start building these on a local level. Because I think you will find that, and I'm sure most of you guys already, you know, have some sort of organization that you're working with, but that, you know, there's something very powerful in that, and that we all need support. We all need to be inspired and encouraged and stay positive. So that's it.
So now that the speakers have said what they have to say, we're all interested in what you all think of everything. So we're gonna try and keep this. We want to hear what you have to say on everything, but we're gonna try and structure it by what has been said already. So the first theme that we'll be going with is in general representation in movement. What you all think of that? By representation, I mean age, sexual orientation, ethnicity, political orientation, issue orientation, however you want to define that. So we'll start taking a stack. Just raise your hand if you want to ask the panelists a question.
It's sort of an observation and a question around representation of immigrants. Mike, you had mentioned before the decision on by UFPJ to turn February 15th into a rally as opposed to a march. I think that most people, I don't know if most people are aware, but the reason that we made that decision was because to turn it into a march without a permit wouldn't have opened up the possibility of confrontation with the police. It would have, you know, it was the virtual impossibility of not having confrontation with the police. And what that would have done is it would have alienated certain communities that wouldn't have been able to put themselves in a position of being arrested or being injured and that sort of thing. At the same time, I apologize, I've forgotten your name. You had mentioned the difficulty of bringing, that there are immigrant communities in particular who want to be out on the streets, who want to be, you know, publicly demonstrating, but are putting themselves at very serious risk if they do. And this is sort of like two sides of a very difficult, you know, a very difficult problem. It was precisely immigrant communities and children and the elderly and people with physical disabilities that made us decide that ultimately we would back down from the police. So the observation is that, number one, it was a very difficult decision. It wasn't taken lightly. And the question is, for those of us who are trying to find creative ways to, you know, who are committed to bringing different communities and diverse communities into the movement, how do we resolve these two issues? On the one hand, wanting to bring immigrants from other communities in, and on the other hand, not wanting to limit our dissent to, you know, those possibilities dictated by the police and by the city, et cetera. I mean, I think we would all agree with the generalization that we've got to find ways, but what are those ways is my question.
I don't know the solution to that. I think that's something a lot of groups are facing right now and are trying to work on, but I would just give... I just want to give one example of something that happened in Williamsburg where we tried to address that issue and also incorporate what was something that was already happening, which was within a Latino community. We had the stations, the Latino community, a Transfiguration Church and All Saints, St. Barbara's Church were having the Stations of the Cross March. which happens every year, Easter. And what they decided was to make it an anti-war, a peace demonstration in a sense. It was a religious ceremony, but they also wanted to make a strong anti-war statement. And so El Puente and Peace Williamsburg worked on this, and we came up with a leaflet that linked each point, each station on the cross, have an anti-war message. And we also handed out War Resister League leaflets. And it was a beautiful, I mean, it's a beautiful thing that happens every year, but it became more than just this religious event. It became a really strong anti-war event. And it was on the cover of El Diario and, you know, got a lot of attention in the press. So I think maybe that's one way to, like, rather than ask for the community to come to our events or you know, events that are specifically anti-war or whatever, but to look at into the communities and say, how can we incorporate an event that happens already? Summer's a great opportunity where there are a lot of things happening in communities. How can we go into, you know, Williamsburg Bridge celebration. We had a big celebration, and Peace Williamsburg had a stand there, and you know, that was one way, another way maybe, but it's hard. But I think we need to look into the community and see what already exists.
I think the two have to be mutually exclusive. I think that there can be all different forms and strategies, and that they can happen as long as if they're happening in coordination and in solidarity and with accountability to communities. I think it's okay for you know, organizations not in immigrant communities or not in people of color communities to do actions that make sense for their community. But it's also important for them to be in communication with and maybe coincide it with other safer activities happening in the boroughs, maybe on the same day with messaging coming from there. Again, with Homeland Resistance, even though the folks who got arrested, I mean, civil disobedience is not something that, like, most folks in my community were like, yay, let's do it, and they weren't there. But it wasn't an action that was created for them to participate. It was something that, like, person after person in jail, family members were saying, what are all these citizens doing? Why aren't they getting arrested at that building? And we want them to do that. And so the direction came from that. But what was also important is that that action happened, but the messaging, the political messaging, came from directly affected communities. So I think there's all ways to collaborate strategies.
Yeah, I have one response and kind of a counter observation. In terms of how to involve communities of color or, you know, whatever community it is, it's very simple. You just make the issue relate to the community. How is it affecting me, my life? How is this war affecting my job? How is it affecting the people in my neighborhood, my family? Just bring it home to the conditions of the lives of the people that you want to reach out to. In terms of the organizing and the permit situation and all of that, I'm opposed to working with the police, and I'm opposed to getting permits, and I'm opposed to peacekeepers and people with armbands and all of that stuff. People should be allowed to march freely in the streets. And what we saw, and of course, you know, this is 2020 hindsight, and I realize, you know, you're all good people trying to do a very difficult and thankless chore, but what we saw was that the police attacked us. And it wasn't, I hate to disagree with you, it wasn't only the youth bloc that got attacked. Part of the labor contingent was a red and black bloc. And we blocked up and we got into fights with the mounted officers who came charging us. So, you know, we were attacked as well. And it didn't matter, you know, that there was a permit or no permit or peacekeepers or anything. People should just be allowed to march. This situation with permits should just be dispensed with.
First of all, I think... first of all, I think the issue has already been brought home to a lot of these communities that we want to reach out to, even more so than some of our own communities sometimes when we're talking about a position from which we're addressing others, possibly from a position of privilege, you know, that might be afforded us by where we come from. But
for youth, for example, the issue has been brought home. So if you want to outreach to youth, there are youth organizing, there are people of color organizing. And I think that we have to be there when they're organizing for themselves and not just, as someone mentioned, expect them to come to our actions. I also recognize the importance of a safe space for immigrants. There were several undocumented immigrants in Youth Block who felt that they were going to be deported and never see, you know, their family again after February 15th. But I think it was, people wanted to march, but they didn't have a safe space to march. So they formed feeder marches that were even more unsafe than it would have been if people had marched en masse. And we were just kind of corralled and police officers just kind of rode their horses through us. And I think that it would have been better if there was a massive place that people could go who wanted to march and a massive place that people could go who just had a safe space to rally. You know, kind of, I favor the idea of a green zone, say, and a yellow zone. I think it's important to have different places that people can go at different risks and different levels that people are able to take action. And a friend of mine from Bangladesh literally almost got arrested that day. And I think it just would have been a lot better for all of us, including those most at risk, if the decision had been taken to provide that space.
And then we'll go back to questions.
Two things, just in terms of the formulation that we're using around the work of communities of color, people of color.
Wow.
In terms of the formulation that we're using, some of the language around this, I just want to try to highlight some of the politics that are embedded in it. It's really not about outreach to communities of color. Right? Communities of color, I think this is the point that one of you is driving at, communities of color are organizing. Right? Communities of color are very conscious about the political situation. The question is, what are ways that we can work with communities of color to support the organizing that's going on there, to strengthen it, and to ally with it as comrades? That's, I think, the question on the table. So that's, in working with each other, you know, in Boston, one of the steps that I think has been very positive, a lot of the more traditionally white peace organizations have started to work more closely with the immigrant rights organization, Latino community, other places. Support their demonstrations along the lines of some of the things that Monami mentioned and so on, and just get to know each other, find out what the issues are. And a lot of folks have found out, hey, there's a lot of shit they didn't know about the war. They didn't know about, you know, issues in communities of color and immigrants, right? So that, I think, is a very important, you know, approach to the question that I think we need to think about. So that's one. The second thing is, when you choose tactics like whether or not to march and blow off the cops and that kind of thing, you always have to have, I think, a very realistic, a very sober assessment of the actual balance of forces, right? If you end up taking a set of actions where there aren't a lot of people who even know that you're thinking about taking them, like if you were to walk through the pens and all that, if you do that and people aren't prepared, you're going to lose a lot of people. Aside from the issue of endangering people physically, getting them thrown in jail and so on, you have to think about that. Right, and one of the questions I think on February 15th was there were hundreds of thousands of people who I can guarantee you had never been out to a demonstration before. And then to put them in a situation where the first time they're getting involved politically, potentially, and expect them then to be ready to go out against the cops, doesn't make sense. And that was largely the sentiment of people in the room at the United for Peace meeting, where we made a democratic decision not to go beyond that. So those folks who are ready, we should create opportunities for people to do that. But don't expect everybody else who aren't there politically, you know, who, you know, have other risks that, you know, don't come along with folks who they can't take risks because other folks have privilege relative to them. Keep that in mind and figure out ways in which if you're going to do civil disobedience, okay, fine, do it, but maybe a few blocks away, right? But, you know, keep that in mind when we have to really be conscious of how do we, this is the challenge of building a multiracial peace and justice movement in a global city like New York that is more than two-thirds people of color. It's a completely different dynamic than it was in the 60s. And so we got to really carefully think about how do we build these alliances over time, not get too far out ahead of some folks, not get too far behind some other folks. So just as a sort of framework for thinking about how to make those calls.
I wanted to give a concrete example of something that I was a part of in the past that I think was a really good example of different communities working together around a diversity of tactics and really people having respect for each other. And I think that's what is going to build a movement or kill a movement is if we start disrespecting what somebody else is doing and brushing off and calling it reformist or whatever. I think that just kills it right away. It's going to push people away. And I'm coming from Cincinnati, and in April of 2001, we had a rebellion against police murdering black men in our city. And that rebellion was coming from the neighborhoods where black men were getting killed. And these incredibly marginalized communities that are seriously at risk fighting with police. And that resulted in hundreds of people being thrown in jail. Some people are still in jail. That was April 2001. By June, we had organized an event to protest this. In between April and June, there had been a big dialogue between different groups. What do we want to do? Some of us wanted to do what we call direct action. We wanted to shut something down. We wanted to really like physically mess with the gears. But we said, you know what, we can't take this down to over the Rhine. We can't take this down to the neighborhood that's getting attacked and just throw this in the middle of this march. There's a lot of people that can't be part of that scene. So there was a dialogue the whole time with the groups in the neighborhoods that were organizing, and even the mother of the most recent person that had been murdered that was heading up this coalition. We said, well, what do we do? Like, we feel like this is how we want to express our dissent, and we understand that this needs to be a safe space. They said, well, don't fuck shit up and over the Rhine. Take it up to Mount Adams. Take it up to the really wealthy kind of like brewery district where all the middle class white people were going out and drinking while there was curfew in over the Rhine. And we were like, oh, that's an amazing suggestion. So like a concrete example is that, so on June 2nd, you know, everybody had a huge march through over the Rhine. We went to the site where Timothy Thomas was murdered. We went to these places. An hour later, we met up in Mount Adams and started shutting streets down and started saying, you guys can't just fucking party up here while people are being killed. And it worked out. We got to do what we wanted to do, and people were safe and able to, you know, to work through all that. And that helped to build future things, too. And I think that's really the thing, is we need to look at every mobilization opportunity is also an opportunity to build respect between groups and to open up a respectful dialogue about what's possible and how do we want to move forward.
I agree with Chris that I don't like the cops and people should be able to march. But you have to have power in order to stop the cops. And that brings us back to the organizing. I wish that, you know, I had known more about what I knew that something had happened in Cincinnati, but not as much as you told me. It would be great if all of these different experiences could somehow get into war times, which is a great tool for going out and talking to people on the street. Right after 9/11, there was a very big meeting at Charis. I think Dan was there. There were a lot of people. We formed an organization called War Is Not the Answer. I don't know what happened to all of those people, and I hope that we can keep these connections together and share ideas. I'm not used to having summer weather, so I've been wearing an anti-war button on my coat, and I forgot to put it on my shirt. But people come over, and New Yorkers Say No to War have a great t-shirt that say New Yorkers Say No to War. People come over and talk to me, and I think everybody should be wearing buttons and talking to people, and we need to put our heads together to put out simple literature that we can use to talk to people. And I think, how do you form a community? How do you reach out in the community? So I live on West 10th Street, and somehow it doesn't seem like it's possible to form a community organization there. But I went with New Yorkers Say No to War and United for Peace and Justice last Sunday, Tompkins Square Park, where I got there late, but there was a table with a petition to the city council to say we wouldn't abide by the Patriot Act. And a piece of paper, which I handed out to people and said, go sign the petition. Lots of people did it. I said, save the Bill of Rights. I mean, whether you can organize people to come to a meeting, to organize a meeting in their house that you can go talk to, but they'll take literature, and maybe if enough of us in enough places in the city and the country actually, or the world, we're reaching out. We need to have good educational material. I also have this idea that we should have a sticker that says that we can put on signs that say support the troops. It's a sticker that says bring them home now. I think that we need the literature that Mike was talking about, that people are fighting for self-determination, because the press talks about, well, the American or British troops were attacked and that they weren't doing anything. Well, of course they're in somebody else's country. What the hell are they doing there? but we need to do a lot more of outreach organizing, and we need to somehow keep in touch with each other and find out what can do to support all the different struggles. And that way maybe we can organize enough so we can tell the cops to go jump in the Hudson River.
I was really struck by some of the models that you presented, Monami. Sort of the model, it's like entirely two different sort of spheres of doing things in a way, like the whole way of activism versus community organizing. And the community organizing aspect is definitely something new, and maybe that's something that is so new and it's arriving to make up for the lack that the so-called state has fallen behind it, because welfare in general has sort of fallen with neoliberalism. And I know this is a very selfish question, just because this is something that I've been grappling with as a person that has a certain type of analysis, and this is a question for you, Chris, too, as well, because it has a certain type of analysis, but has a certain type of political and philosophical outlook and approaches the organizing or the activist work that I do, and is inspired by that. Like, where do you take the direction from? Is it your analysis, or is it the community? You know, I mean, it is assuming two different ways of looking at things when you think about it. Like, you could be inspired by your political viewpoint, or you could be inspired by the community seeing that somehow the answer is, like you said, Monami, you ask the detainees for where should you protest? You know, under what conditions should you protest? And how would that jeopardize? And what are the implications for whatever decisions for which community or for which direction you take those answers from? If you take the answers from the community, is it possible that, let's say, for a very short period of time, a lot of them have very short-term goals, they want to be out of jail. They don't see so far-reaching, and it's not their fault that they don't, but they don't have that transformative social vision that sometimes an analysis can give you. You know, an analysis maybe that's not behind bars, that isn't persecuted on a daily basis because of the color of their skin, but you know, that can provide you. So I'm curious about how maybe both of you could sort of speak to that.
Do you want to go first?
Good question. But I think, okay, so one thing is, I don't think they're things that are on the opposite ends of the spectrum, like analysis and then organizing and people and communities. We are openly and firmly a progressive and left organization within our community. We clearly come from that political perspective, and we're clear about that. And that's the leadership, and that's the political analysis and vision that we're developing within working class South Asian diasporas in the U.S. And within immigrant communities. That's why we exist. Community organizing is a really loaded term. Like I said, it's got a history of its own. The best community organizers in the U.S. is the Christian right, and probably is the right in general, and the government. They're doing a hell of a lot better job than, you know, for the most part, the left has. And I think one of the fundamental issues is because we're not organizing in the same way. We're not really going to our own neighborhoods, our own buildings, where we came from, suburbia, or wherever it is, and working there, doing the hard work. So I think organizing, you know, is important, but organizing has a whole spectrum of political analysis, just like anything else does. And so we don't practice a kind of organizing where it's just about some sort of false, you know, representational politics. But it's about longer vision of social change, institutional change, and really left analysis that for us, we know in immigrant communities, it's really hard for us to survive because we're seen as, well, this really radical, you know, marginal group. And but we've been building over the past few years a stronger and stronger base, because not all immigrant groups are assimilationists and mainstream. Not all people of color, you know, just want to, you know, survive and like get whatever whatever access and privileges that we're lacking. I think one of the scariest things in the whole debate around analysis and action that happens is that when they get removed, there's this notion that analysis happens in a vacuum up there by people not affected by issues, by people reading and theoretically understanding the issues. And we absolutely don't practice that. We believe that analysis happens most and best from the people who live globalization, imperialism, war, day to day. And that is people in our community. And that's where we develop our analysis from.
I very much support that answer, so I'll be very brief. Really, I don't see a dichotomy either. I'm part of a community. I don't see that I come from a vacuum of organizing. I work. I live in a building. I walk my dog, and that's where I talk to people, and that's where I organize. In terms of me sitting here as a white person, I would just tell you that my local union is primarily people of color, and District Council 37 is primarily people of color, and that's where we've done this organizing. In the Ninth Law Coalition, I would make reference to Brenda Stokely, the president of AFSCME 1707. This is a union largely populated by people of color. In public sector unions in New York are low-wage earners. It's very unusual in my situation with the New York Public Library Guild, and it's cause of a lot of strife in the local. You know, a lot of librarians, I imagine the situation is similar with teachers, you know, they feel they have a quote-unquote professional degree. They're too good to be in a union. They don't want to be in a union with black people. That exists. But I would say that, you know, my interactions are holistic. They're organic. I don't come from anywhere else than Monami does.
I just wanted to make a comment before I say it. I just want to, say something. I'm a person of color, and I'm very aware of my position. However, I think that what I usually see is that people usually tend to eulogize the communities of color and the immigrants' community. Well, I think it's really much more complex than that. I mean, I see the issue of racism against the communities of color and immigrants. But at the same time, I think that these communities are not really homogeneous group of people. They're very, very different. You know, you can look in, let's say, I'm from Iran, for example. You can look in my community. We are very different people. Very different people. We have gays, we have lesbians, we have communists, we have socialists, we have religious fascists. We have all kinds of people. We have nationalists. So we are very, very different. Very different. And if you look into other communities, they are really, really different. They're very, very different. I work in Jersey City, and I work in a building where there is a shelter. A lot of women who come to this shelter are Middle Eastern. They're running away from their husbands. They're running away from their fathers. They're running away from their uncles. And they're running away from their brothers, because there is a lot of violence against women in many of these communities. Right? Now, I work for communities of color. I had bosses, I'm telling you, I'm not kidding with you. I had bosses who were from my community. I couldn't work for him for 2 days. The guy was absolutely a jerk. I couldn't work for him. He was absolutely a jerk. The second day, I was about to punch him in the head. I'm a good worker. I'm a very, very, very good worker. I work very hard. But I couldn't work for him. Right? So this is really a complex issue. We really, really have to, yes, we have to take a position against racism, against attack on immigrants, but we have to realize that these communities are really different. You know, we have to realize women in communities of color is important to reach out to them. Gay and lesbian, there is a lot of homophobia against them in communities of color, in my community. It's horrible. You know, I run away from them sometimes. You know, I just can't bear them talk. I mean, I try to teach them, you know, I try to explain to them. But you really have to look at these dynamics. It's really, really important. Sometimes I feel like I'm being patronized. I don't really need that. You know what I mean? I don't really need that, you know? I have a partner who's a white woman, and so, you know, I hang around with her family, and I have a lot of white friends, and I also have a lot of friends from communities of color. So I'm kind of very aware of these dynamics. And I know people do that with a very good intention, you know, from the bottom of their heart, they care, because they're really against racism. They see the suffering and the brutality that the people of color, you know, go through in this country. But at the same time, I think we really need to find out who is our friend in this community. We really, really have to look really closely. We can't stand on the side when a woman in the Arab community is being beaten up by her husband. If a girl in Arab community cannot come up with a headscarf because she's afraid that when she goes back, she's going to be kicked around by her father. No, I think these are really important. We really have to look at them very, very closely. These are the kind of things that help us to come closer to communities of color. Organizing is not just fighting against the, you know, INS or the US government or the Homeland Security. Organizing is about also fighting for people in this community, for women, for gays, for lesbians, for workers, for all of them who are really vulnerable in their own community. So I just want to kind of explain this, but I think we should really look at this if we want to really build relationship with these communities.
I just want to respond, but also explain a little bit about how we do that. I was saying that in the past 6 months, we decided to take a step back because we were just responding to all the attacks around immigration and deportation, stepping back and creating long-term community organizations that are progressive means exactly that. It means working on issues of power and privilege within our own communities. And from the beginning of DRUM, our mission was twofold. One was to fight the external forces of racism, institutional, you know, immigration policies. But the other half of that is to really struggle for progressive spaces within our communities, to actively fight racism, sexism, homophobia, and class privilege within our communities. And actually, in the first few years of DRUM, we spent most of our time doing that. And I think one of the harder struggles for communities of color is that we have to do both, but within the context of living within a power structure that is white supremacist, and we can't ignore that. I think that communities of color need to address and challenge oppression within their own communities, but it has to be on our own terms. It has to be for self-determination. It can't be brokered by other people, and often it is. I can give a concrete example of that. In a lot of the detention work, what ended up happening in some ways was that there were a lot of non-immigrant communities that took a lot of leadership. A lot of white organizations, legal organizations that took leadership in building a movement for Arab communities and South Asian communities around detention. And what ended up happening, and the reason that sort of racism really hinders us from building just movements within our own communities is that a lot of those folks became gatekeepers for our community. And what that meant was, you know, those are the folks who have resources, who have access to media and funds and support, And so they were the ones who decided, well, this is a good immigrant organization and this is not. This is a good Arab organization and this is not. And a lot of times those happen on political lines so that organizations, particularly in the Arab and South Asian community that are more radical within their own communities and already marginalized and red-baited and called communists and all these sorts of things, were organizations that were are being propped up in these political moments. And I think that's why it's really important to understand the complexity of racism, but really from the perspective of self-determination for communities of color. There are issues within our communities, but we have to be the ones to take them on. It can't be brokered by people outside of our community.
I wanted to throw out an idea, talking about possible situations or opportunities or events to maybe facilitate processes and coming together and so forth. Next year, Emperor George, you want to have his coronation here in New York, and I know that seems a long way off, but it's not that far off. And of course, they're going to be using it, in an incredible way to solidify their hold. And I would like to throw out the idea that perhaps this can be an opportunity. In addition to, or instead of just demonstrating or complaining or whatever, but to somehow use it to turn it into a showcase for positive ideas, whether that's street theater, guerrilla theater, I don't have any one particular solution other than some ideas for some theater projects.
Yeah. Just that I wanted to, in terms of looking forward, there's some things that are important to touch on. One is what's going on with the project in Iraq and in the Middle East, even Afghanistan. I think that's important because it's not over, clearly, and increasingly the situation does not look good for the United States. And I think that can work in our favor quite a bit, and if we know how to use it and follow up on it and figure out what's going on. The difficulty in the Middle East is the question of solidarity. We saw that during the war, to be able to connect with movements there in Iraq and other places. The most obvious is the Palestinian, the Intifada in Palestine. Obviously, that's an immediate and important one. It's important, even though it's not in Iraq, it's the main counter to the building an American empire in the Middle East is if they can defeat the Intifada, as they're trying to do with this roadmap right now. And that's why I think the Palestine issue is an important issue. But I think if you look at Afghanistan, they've managed to kind of cover it up, but the situation is quite dire there. Now heroin, they're saying heroin is, once again, Afghanistan is the top heroin exporter in the world, and the warlords are back in power, and all that comes with it. Iraq, again, we're seeing a situation where soldiers are being picked off almost daily. It's unclear quite is this a phenomena that's going to appear and then disappear, or to what extent it will take on a form of popular resistance. I think if we can make, I think that's important terrain, even though it's there for us, and it'll have a lot to do with how much we can succeed in our attempt to change the agenda. So I think that's an important thing to observe. The more difficult thing for me, generally in terms of the bigger movement, is obviously the electoral terrain, and which is, as everyone probably agrees here, is quite miserable in the United States. Although even within the Democratic Party, anti-war sentiment is happening, and it's forms giving some expression inside of there, which means it's fairly serious. But I think that's maybe where the Republican National Convention can give us an activist outlet for trying to influence the elections in some sort of way. I really think that those demonstrations can be very critical, and it can be your way if you don't believe in supporting the Democratic Party, which is a very understandable sentiment, that's, I think, an activist way of approaching the issue. But it does, I think, whether we like it or not, much big sections of the movement, people who are marching with us, are thinking very, I think this is the next biggest and most important thing for them. And it's also something we have to understand, that whether they fall in line behind the Democrats and so on, they desperately want to get rid of the Bush people. They're so desperate, they'll do anything. But I think we should try to have a say in that, not just ignore them and dismiss them, and we should really build up for the convention.
Just two quick points in response to that. First of all, I think that the movement and various organizations within it have a tendency to become a little bit fixed in their ideas and their responses to things. And I think it's really important. You were mentioning the changing situations. I think we have to bear in mind how we respond to actual conditions on the ground as they change. They change from day to day and week to week. And a lot of people are just saying the same things that we've been saying for a really long time. Whether that's based on ideologies of various stripes, radical, liberal, peacenik, whatever, I think that we have to respond and keep thinking dynamically in terms of how are we going to change our response and how are we going to change and adapt the movement to what's really going on in these places, and how are we going to develop alternate sources of information for people who are seeking them out, but in some cases are having trouble finding alternates to, you know, the mainstream media. People want to hear what's really going on, but they're not hearing it from the mainstream media, and we have to develop those channels further, I think, of finding out what's going on and responding to it. Secondly, in terms of electoral politics, I'm pretty much just as cynical about it as you all are, but we have to be able to organize. We have to be able to have the right to assemble, the right to dissent. We have to not have a Patriot Act too. We have to be able to continue to challenge those in positions of power who want to take away every single one of our rights that people have fought and shed blood for over hundreds of years in our country. And I think that defeating Bush in 2004 might be just necessary in order to keep and guard the right to just be out in the streets. I mean, we assert it when we go out in the streets and when we take the streets, but at the same time, we have to be aware that we are under attack like no time in the memory of anyone, you know, who's around my age, possibly in a much longer time than that. And I think that we just have to be really conscious of what's going on and how we can defeat that, both in terms of the grassroots and building up from the communities upward, ground up, but at the same time making sure that they don't take away all that we have left. And I think it's just important to be realistic. And I mean, this recent Bush protest on Monday, me and my girlfriend and a whole bunch of other people were just kind of rounded up and detained for hours and questioned about our political affiliations without. And so I think that we're living in really dangerous times, and that's made more concrete for young people and as well as for people in communities that have been targeted for a long time. But for people who didn't even know what was going on, it's being made really personal and really direct, and we have to address that.
So a couple things. More on the question of race, people of color, racism in the movement. There's going to be a forum at the Brecht Forum on Monday at 7:30. Merle's got some information about it, where there were a number of people who've been involved in the anti-war movement, developed a letter that we sent out, I think, in late February, something like that, about racism movement, trying to discuss some experiences that we had and to talk about ways that we can try to alter that situation in great detail. And it's attracted a lot of interest and engagement with hundreds of people, literally hundreds of people, sending us emails in response to it. So we encourage people to participate in that, to have some further discussion about some of the dynamics that work here. I want to be clear about this. This is not about like hit people over the head with it. It's about saying let's acknowledge dynamics that have played out in our work, identify them so we can fix them, as we do in any problem. If I'm a man being sexist, someone better call me out so I can deal with it. That's what it's about. So I encourage people to just do that. Second thing, I think the last point about electoral politics, I think, is really right. Like it or not, over the next year and a half, the elections are largely going to determine the context in which we do our work. shortly after September 11th, it was Afghanistan. After that, it was Palestine, right? Remember the march on April 20th in D.C., I think it was April 20th, right? It was Palestine that was the center of the movement. After that, it was Iraq. In this period, it's going to be the elections, like it or not. We don't have control over that. That's just the fact of living in the United States. So I think it's very, and it's going to be on people's minds, and it's going to be one of the major ways in which we can engage people in a discussion about peace and justice. So we have to find ways to engage in that. You may think, I'm not a Democrat by any means. I don't want to see them in office. Nonetheless, we have to find ways to engage people where they're at and what they're thinking about. And I think the last point about this is that if large sections of the movement, I think something like 50%, there was some poll that came out, 50% of people that were part of the anti-war movement or that were anti-war, had anti-war sentiment, were Democrats. So let's take that for, that's a reality. So that means we need to engage people in a discussion about politics and find a way to impact politics and the debate that are going on in the Democratic Party, in the Green Party, anywhere that's going on. We need to find ways to do that. It doesn't mean supporting a candidate necessarily, but it does mean we have to think consciously about it. United for Peace and Justice, one of the ways we're talking about it, or we came out of the conference in Chicago, the agreement to participate in the Republican in demonstrations at the Republican Convention and Democratic Convention. There's a lot of other work we can do too. I mean, one of the ways to think about this is when we were in LA in some of the community organizing I did in LA, around propositions, these propositions that the right wing were throwing down our throats from 187, 227, 209, I can tell you more and more numbers, we would use it as an opportunity to do precinct organizing, to turn people out to oppose these things, but also to build our base. It gives you an opportunity. It's a real thing. There's a vote on the table. There's a choice in front of people. People know about it. You can have a conversation with people and build your organizations. Why can't we think about that similarly in this electoral period and think creatively about it, not with a very hard position that electoral politics, forget about it, it's just, it's under control of the capitalists or whatever. We may think analytically. Nonetheless, we have to think about ways we can utilize that situation.
I would support a lot of what Hani said, but I also want to point out that I don't think people should be blaming themselves for voting for Nader. That we have to remember that, Bush didn't win the election, that, and I think we really need to keep stressing this point, it's not ancient history, it was only, it's a short while ago, that Bush was able to get into office because 57,000 people were not allowed to vote in Florida, and that was just in Florida, so, imagine how many people were denied the right to vote around the country. I mean, I think we need to make an issue of that, that someone who won by, what, I think it was like 570 votes in Florida, while there's 57,000 people were denied the right to vote, that's outrageous, and we can't forget that. That needs to be something that is addressed while we also address making sure that Bush is not in office. But we also, I think it's important that we not just elect anybody other than Bush. I certainly don't support that, and I think a lot of people are really panicking about that at this point already and saying, if we don't support the Democrat who's most likely to win, then we're screwed. Well, I just don't, I don't think that's the right way to go about it. I think we do need to support those progressive voices and not necessarily support one candidate, but to support the, I think we need to go into details of what these different candidates are saying and support different issues. Not just say, okay, we have our solution, we have our candidate. I don't think it's that simple. And I think, that if Nader wasn't so progressive about what he was saying, then we wouldn't, I don't know that we would necessarily be in the situation that we are now. I think we a lot of people blame Nader, but I think he did a lot for the movement that we need to focus on too.
I have a brief announcement to make before we go on, and I just want to say it now because it touches on disenfranchisement. The NAACP Legal Fund is working on a sort of free the vote campaign. Ex-convicts are not allowed to vote, and that ends up disenfranchising a lot of Hispanics and minorities and other minorities. In relation to that, Critical Resistance is an organization dedicated to building a world without prisons. That's what it says here on the flyer. They're having a benefit party in Brooklyn tonight, actually, and it starts at 9 p.m. It's going to be at 968 Atlantic Avenue on the first floor. I have a flyer here if you need directions.
Yeah, people seem to be
saying similar things, but actually I think there's a big difference. I think there's actually a big difference in something people are saying. I think everyone agrees you can't ignore the fact that electoralism is going to sweep the country. That people are already, there's a big push inside the movement, people have turned towards looking at the Democrats, concentrating on the Democrats, getting involved in the Democrats, and so on and so forth. That's a fact, and we can't ignore that. And we should find ways of addressing and working together with people who we might not agree with on this. The example already been raised, of course, in New York City. The Republican convention is going to be a very big deal. We're going to be doing lots of different things around that. And some of us may go off to Boston also with the Democrats that I'm in the country. So certainly it is not a question of ignoring it. However, there is a question of whether we should be participating in or advocating, working with the Democrats, supporting the Democratic candidates in some way. And partly, this gets to the question that the sister over there asked earlier about, you know, if you're a radical, how do you, you know, talk to other people? And partly, I'm not in favor of, you know, two layers of communicating with people. One layer saying, we'll just be militants, nobody but us militants here. And then later on saying, but by the way, I personally think that we need a revolution or something. I'm not going to tell most people that until they, you know, time for the secret. To support the Democrats, you know, I mean, especially it blows the mind talking about Palestinians. The Democratic Party, if anything, is more anti-Palestinian, more pro-Israel, if anything, of the two parties. The Democratic Party is more likely to back the Israeli regime in attacking the Palestinians, at least if there's any difference at all. Of course, in most issues, I would say there's no difference. In most issues, you would say that it's not that the Democrats are the same as the Republicans, but the Democrats are capable of fighting against the Democrats, the Republicans. And we've seen that over and over again. That doesn't mean we should make an effort, and I certainly don't make an effort to tell people not to vote. That's what they want to do. They're not going to make an effort. Somebody's willing to accept that the Democrats are a lesser evil, I'll say, fine, as long as we agree they're an evil. You know, if that's, you know, let's talk about other ways of organizing. But it's a key distinction here, and I'll wrap up here. It's a key distinction whether we want to focus on the movement as putting pressure on the rulers from below, and that way pushing on them, breaking those laws by the sheer fact. The biggest blow against Patriot Act, all the other forms of repression, was the mass movement. If there isn't a mass movement, they can do any damn thing they want, and the Democrats are going to vote for it too. Between whether for that kind of thing or whether you think, well, we'll get some nice guys in there and they're going to vote good things and so forth, we all know that's not going to
happen. I just want to talk about two things. First, I think, I don't know if someone mentioned it, but during the anti-war work, during the anti-war work, we did have quite a big victory, which was that the NYPD told us we couldn't march on February the 5th. Then on March 22nd, of course, they miraculously allowed us to march. So I think that's an important victory that we should bear in mind. If you think on the Democratic Party thing, I think it's quite a difficult and complex question with no simple one-line answers to it. I just think, you know, the thing that's complex about the Democratic Party is that Kucinich is very different to Lieberman. And therefore to say, well, you know, to hell with all Democrats becomes a bit difficult. You know, so I think it's something that we need to discuss more and think through more because of its complexity. But in fact, Kucinich goes around and gives very good anti-war talks to union members. And that's the reason he won't be the Democratic candidate. But I think, you know, that this is clearly a difficult and complex issue.
Yeah, I just want to say something. I think it goes back to what Hani's saying about the difference between sort of strategy and tactics. And I think also the thing that Monami was saying about, you know, who's been organizing the world the Christian right place. And the Christian right doesn't fetishize a particular kind of organizing. The Christian right doesn't fetishize, we're going to do only this kind of organizing or media or this. They understand it's a holistic process of power and trying to, you know, to have a better balance of forces in terms of relations of power in this country. And I think when we look at electoral work and see civil disobedience, direct action, organizing, mobilizing, agitating, it's a question of, you know, figuring out, like, what do we do to change the balance of forces to, we have a number of things to do. One is we have to deal with this, you know, extreme right wing of the government that we're experiencing now with Bush, but at the same time realize the systemic nature of it. How do we balance trying to push back that and get enough space for us to do the organizing, for us to defeat the Patriot Act, you know, to, you know, pull back the most aggressive edge of the U.S. war drive, to preserve, to develop that space, and at the same time, you know, not falling into, you know, any Democrat is okay no matter what. So I think it's really a balance we have to think strategically now, and, you know, not fetishizing what tactics. You know, there's been a discussion in this country for a million years about independent politics versus Democratic Party, which has not really gotten us anywhere. So the question is, you know, what is the real balance of forces on the ground? What can we really do? The other thing I just wanted to say, just going back for 1 second to the question that was raised about civil disobedience and mass action involving people. I think that there are certain communities that can't take part in civil disobedience because they really are at risk, immigrant communities, other particularly at risk groups. But I don't want to, I think it's important not to have a dichotomy that people of color can't take part in civil disobedience. Because I think if you look at the history of civil disobedience in this country, where does the leadership come from? It comes from the civil rights movement, the Black Power and other power movements in the 60s. If you look at the Amadou Diallo case, that's successful. To a certain extent, CD came out of the communities of color. So I don't want to, I think it's important not to say that, you know, CD and direct action is for white folks and the people of color don't do it. And I didn't say, nobody said that, but I really want to emphasize that. But the bigger point has to do with how do we build a strategy? The other thing is who develops a strategy? You know, the anti-war movement has one task. The organizations in different communities have another task. We don't really have, you know, an organization that kind of coordinates that. So that's another problem. The Christian right has that. They're a kind of general body that coordinates their strategy. We're sort of having to put that together.
Yeah. Before I say my comment, we're probably going to wrap it up in a little bit. I think some people are probably getting hot and tired. So I guess it'll be up to the facilitators, but maybe only a few more comments and then some of us are this fundraiser. I just wanted to say something. In terms of Kucinich and the electoral politics, I mean, I think just like anything else, it's a vehicle through which we can express our own politics. And sometimes Kucinich, someone like Kucinich, like someone like Nader, like an institution like the United Nations, which personally a lot of us might not have 100% trust in and understand that they are, in certain situations, only means by which the United States exerts its power over other countries. At the same time, these are very real places where we can exert our political force and are able to actually go out in the communities and talk to people. Because the fact of the matter is, a lot of us aren't amazing organizers, and we need things to talk to the communities about. And Ralph Nader definitely was that in 2000. I think Kucinich definitely is going to be that in 2004. And I think the United Nations was that for an amount of time organizing against the war in Iraq. And I think people, I think, especially coming from the anarchist or anti-authoritarian perspective, I think oftentimes brush off electoral politics in the sense that there's no differentiation between long-term and short-term goals and being able to work long-term while understanding that short-term we have to mobilize people, and that includes mobilizing people politically, kind of in a radical way through different modalities. And I think it's a mistake not to take those paths through whatever we have.
I think the people who are saying you have to defeat Bush at all costs, I would like to defeat Bush at all costs with somebody who was different and somebody who was responsible for the movement. I mean, the idea of thinking there's going to be a knight in shining armor who is going to save us from Bush is really ridiculous. First of all, you have the Democrats who never said no to Bush all the time he was attacking Afghanistan and preparing for war and passing the Patriot Act. The Democrats never said boo. Then you have to remember that in 1964, the people were saying, oh, you must defeat Goldwater at all costs. Vote for Johnson. First of all, Johnson that prevented the Mississippi Freedom Democrats from having a voice at the Democratic Convention. And then he got us into the war in Vietnam. So the idea that you can count on the Democrats in any way, shape, or form is forgetting history. But mainly, we need to build the movement. And I mean, I'm a revolutionary socialist, not an anarchist. I would prefer a proletarian revolution. But until we get sufficiently well organized, sometimes
we'll have
to vote. But I would like where the movement decides the issues and the positions. And okay, somebody is willing to get up and be the spokesperson, but only to say what the movement decides, and we have no control over the people who run as candidates. They run the show, and they will use us, and they will use the anti-war people who think somehow there's a shortcut. There isn't a shortcut. We have to build our own movement.
Yeah, I mean, I identify as an anarchist. I want a world without rulers, of course, but I think part of talking about meeting people where they're at is this notion of listening to what people are saying and moving from there. And I think also if an agenda gets set by a broad group of people to go a certain direction, you can have a dialogue about that. And say, for instance, this movement looks at Democrats. Democrat gets an office, we look four years down the line, they're doing the same thing the Republicans are. Then we can have a discussion about maybe how electoral politics isn't the direction to go. But a lot of people are going to need to go down that road first before we have that conversation. And I think that, you know, this isn't like 1910. You know, this is 2003, and we've seen a lot of movements that have been effective. That aren't so ideological, aren't so strict in their dogma. Ones that inspired me was the Zapatista uprising, learning a lot from that. And then what's going on in Argentina? In Argentina, there was a candidate for president who was saying, if you elect me, I'm going to step down and hand power over to the neighborhood assemblies and all these other things. So that's them working electoral politics, getting that message out, using the mainstream media, but the message was direct democracy. That's funky, you know, that was interesting. Back in the late 60s, the Panthers went to SDS and said, we want to run a presidential campaign. SDS said to the Panthers, that's not radical, we won't do it. Huge fucking mistake. I mean, they could have toured the whole country with a radical message, but instead they were too radical to work with the Panthers and run that program. So, I mean, we got to get over, like, our little ideology and really start thinking of new creative ways to reach people and to open up dialogues like that.
Just very, very quickly. I'm not a fan of electoral politics. I'm not a Democrat. And if I end up voting for one, I'm planning on shooting myself afterward. But I will say this, to the extent that I think a lot of us would agree that we hope that during the course of the next 12 months, we can at least shape the dialogue. There are a number of ways to do that, and one of those ways, by no means the only way, but one of those ways is through the Democratic Party. Again, it's not the only way, and I wouldn't want to see it the main focus. I've heard a lot of discussion in progressive circles around things like letter-writing campaigns to the candidates to try and force their politics to the left, and I just want to make this simple observation, that if over the next 12 months, we want to have an impact on the dialogue among the Democrats. If Hani is correct that 50% of our base is in the Democratic Party, that the way to influence Democratic dialogue, it's not a direct line between us and the candidates. It goes through those people, I think through those misguided liberal Democrats who probably do support our politics, but are not being vocal enough in demanding that action of the candidates. In other words, That portion of our work should not be us trying to force Howard Dean to make more comments against the war, trying to push Kucinich. It should be possibly going directly after the Democrats who are going to nominate those people, going after that portion of the Democratic Party who has a say over what those candidates will be speaking about.
I don't mean to change the discussion. I think it's important. I just wanted to say one thing about Iraq. As you may know, the women in Iraq have been probably the only group who have really lost more than anybody else. Not only because of war and destruction and mass murder, but also because of the rise of Islamism and, you know, tribalism and nationalism. And we all know that they're being kicked out of their workplace if they don't wear hijab, or, you know, they're pushed to go back into the homes, and they're being raped and kidnapped and you know threatened in the street. So that's really really important for us to really you know keep in mind. They have the women in Iraq. They have basically started an organization. Called the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq. They have an office in they have an office in Baghdad and Kirkuk, and they also have they have a newspaper called Equality. It's in Arabic, but they also have a newspaper in English. It's called Women's Right Now. And so I have a little information here for you. One of them is the statement of their organization and the purpose of their organization, and which is you know basically fighting for full and complete equality between men and women, and you know a lot of other stuff against you know mandatory and compulsory veiling and you know separation of religion from the state and education. And so you know if you like it, you know you can. I have only 10 of these, and I really encourage you to look at it because they have really awesome you know position. And also this is about their we're doing some fundraising for them to help them with their newspaper. That is being published in Iraq. There is an email at the bottom here, Shuresh, and if you'd like to help out, donate, if you need information, please contact the email address, and we'll be more than happy to help you out. And that's one thing the anti-war movement has to do, support people in the struggle for freedom.
The last
word's
gonna come
tonight. Alright. Just a quick thought. First of all, the majority of Americans, I would say, are disenfranchised today. People 18 and under are disenfranchised. People who have been in prison at any point in their lives are disenfranchised. People who aren't represented in the government at all, who don't have their views, their personal concerns represented by anyone in the government are disenfranchised. This is mass robbery of us of what we're supposed to be our rights, and I'm not under any illusions that we had those rights, you know, any time during my lifetime at least. And at the same time, I think that we have to realize we are the Democratic lowercase d. We are the Democratic Party. We are, I think, the bearers of the democratic spirit in America, that we are making spaces for people to have power over their own lives in the streets, in the schools, in unions, in unions of youth and students. And I think that, you know, for example, Youth Bloc was a place where people 18 and under who don't have any say in the political process whatsoever, who've been deprived since, you know, the foundation of so-called democracy of any say, can go and actually have a say, and it seems that in democracy with consensus, basically, on most things. And I think that we have to remember that we are democracy. We have to bring it into social, economic, just every cultural, every realm that we can bring it, because it's not happening in the political realm. And I think that once we bring it into our daily lives and into the spaces in which we live and work and learn and can teach, I think that that's when we can really start to liberate, you know, America. As they said, you know, let's liberate Iraq. And my response was always, liberate America. And I think that we can do that.
Let's have some closing remarks. This event was to look backwards and to move forwards. We have plenty of ways to move forward right now. Some of them will be discussed Monday at 7:30 at the Breck Forum. Other issues, originality in the movement, creative ways to turn national issues into local issues, more manageable and real issues. That can be addressed in another forum sometime in the future. I'd just like to thank all of our speakers tonight for their... just have a good night, everybody. Take care.